So this is John Costa on the Spotlight on Heritage recording with my colleague Rob. How are you this week, Rob?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Good, good. We always mention the weather, but it's got a bit cloudy now.
It's warm in this room, and I put the fan on a minute ago, and I noticed that you turned it off, obviously, while we're recording. It's like, so in about half an hour's time, I'll have wilted a pool in the corner.
Well, we could have left it on, and it sounded like, I remember our towels from the tuk-tuk that we recorded when we were in Cambodia, and it sounded like we'd been in a helicopter, I think, if we'd left it on. So this week we're talking to an old friend of ours, maybe, like, you know, I don't mean age as in like we've known her a long time when it comes to these things. Sue Lester from the Leicestershire and Rutland Family History Society. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Nice to come along and have another chat.
Yes, thank you for joining. I think, is this your third visit?
I think it might be.
You did one where we were just talking about family history, and then you were involved in the one that we hosted. You kindly hosted for us at Every Street, talking about the Leicester Unemployed March of 1905.
Indeed, and we also spoke about VE Day.
We did indeed.
At Odeby.
That's right, when we came to your event, didn't we? This is your fourth guest slot. Rosettes all round, I think. That's what we need to do. As family history, rosettes, we need to get some sort of badge or reward, don't we, really? Best behaviour. So thank you for joining me today. Now, there's a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about, if that's all right. Today is the 75th anniversary of the Korean War, started in 1950. And I've got a five-year project going up to 2030 for the 80th anniversary, following two themes, really. One is my mum's uncle, Uncle Georgie, who was in the 1st Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers in London. He was actually stationed at the Tower of London, we've discovered. And while I've been doing my own family research around these 26 people, I think, so far, that have served back to World War I in various stages, myself, my son's in the army now, various grandfathers and uncles through national service, etc., we discovered Uncle George's story, and in 1952, I've got this article from a London paper, all very kind of nice and brown and turning at the corner, where they did the City of London Freedom March with a band, and they said the crowd was like 10 deep either side in complete silence because no one wanted war after World War II. Quite interesting. And he went off in national service. He went to Korea for a year and survived. And came back, never really spoke about it, to be honest. But I've also got a friend in America who's making a documentary about a local unit that was involved in one of the big battles over there from the American perspective. And I think there was like, you know, there wasn't very many of them, and they held off thousands and thousands of the enemy. And not a single one of them lost their life in the whole time that they were there. So he's making this documentary, which next year will be for him, their 75th anniversary next year. And so it's kind of one of those things that it's forgotten about because the cenotaph and Remembrance Sunday and the armistice is all World War I and World War II. Well, of course, as we start losing these people, Korea becomes that next one. Have you had anybody come into family history over the years and say they've got a connection with something like the Korean War or anything? Or is it always World War I and World War II then?
Well, I think if you go back to 2014, 2018, the emphasis very much was on the First World War. You know, people suddenly, with the centenary, wanted to come in and do World War I research. And then, of course, with V-Day 80, people have come in, how do I get my family's, you know, service records from the Second World War, which aren't available online. And so things have changed, I think, over the last 10 years or so. So who knows? But I wouldn't say we have had anybody particularly, although there are records available. Without specific names, I couldn't go into the detail about what exactly you find in those records. For instance, Find My Past have definitely got some records, and the National Archives have as well.
I guess things like the centenary for World War One as well, with people's interest in that. There was obviously there's the national commemoration, and then there's, you know, various organisations like, you know, associations and things like this. You know, I'm thinking of the Western Front Association, for example. Those organisations come into their own, and then the Imperial War Museum, what they've got. But with the interest from people generally, like the populace in stories of their families, do you think that there'll be a push to get World War II records online? Or is there a reason why there isn't? Why it isn't there? Is it because it's too vast? Or,
well, there are obviously sort of issues initially with GDPR and that kind of thing, which is why you can apply for your own family members. Next of kin can apply. It takes about a year. They are digitalising some of them. I'm not quite sure about dates for general public access, But a lot of people are wanting them, but you have to have things like a death certificate of the person that you're wanting to find out more about. But yes, because I think it's almost in living memory, if you like grandparents can remember an uncle or a brother or something like that. Whereas the First World War, it's actually not quite in memory of the actual event war itself.
Now, I remember the very first talk that I came to that you gave at Every Street, and I brought my mum along as we started doing this project, and you were talking about starting to think not in sort of necessarily linear terms, but more sort of, you know, to your left and right, and talking to family members, but not necessarily close, like cousins and aunts and uncles, and starting to just think about different records through, you know, employers and, you know, photography, books from different village magazine or something like that. I guess this is, people have this story in the family, don't they, that happens, and it's just like, well, where do I go? I can't find that story. And you go, we can't, don't find that story, find stories that are around it and try and build a bit of a picture up.
Well, interestingly, going back to the First World War specifically, there are a lot of communities, and we're talking particularly small villages, say in Leicestershire, obviously in Rutland, where a community did the research linked to a war memorial. And at the end of that research, they produced a book. And I was specifically myself involved with researching the names on the Odeby War Memorial, which had previously just been names read out on Remembrance Sunday. And nobody...
With no context or nothing.
And we started taking each person in turn and trying to find a photograph, and we wrote biographies of all of them, and it was published. Now, a lot of other villages in the county have done that. We've got quite a lot of the books at our research centre in Every Street. And it's fascinating because somebody who lived in Nottingham, for instance, happened in 2018 to type in the name of her great uncle. And she found him in this website and book that we'd produced. And she was like, I can't believe that somebody's written about this particular family member. Yeah, I mean, they're not my family at all. They're not my ancestors. So a lot of villages have done that. And it's a great archive as a starting point, particularly if you can't get the service record because it's been destroyed. And as you know, a lot of World War I service records were destroyed. So you've got to go down other avenues to research. And there are other ways into it, but it's more complicated.
Well, I found about 10 family members from World War II, family and extended family. But it was 6 from World War I. Two didn't return, and in World War II, I think three died, two of whom I'm named after, John William. And what's been interesting is looking through their photographs, because we've managed to kind of get them all together and at least one photograph of each person. There's a couple of people doing national service where I've only got them in civilian stuff because they've not got military photos of them. But what's become quite clear is that the unit that you think they're in, you know exactly what I'm going to say now, the photo you've got of them is like, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, I know, you know, Georgie went, for example, to Korea with the 1st Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, and that's what his record says. But the photo I've got of him is in the Royal Sussex Regiment. Yeah. So it's people starting to be brought from other regiments that you've done your training for, and then what you end up fighting with. This is one of those challenges as well, isn't it? Different people with different cap badges and serving in different units and stuff.
Well, yes, I think you spoke to, was it Robin Jenkins, about people moving from one regiment to another. I mean, there are records, obviously, if you've got the full service record, that will tell you that. Going back to the Odeby War Memorial, it's actually quite unusual in as much as it names the regiment. Now, a lot of war memorials, you only get the name. So it's A. Smith. You know, the chances are that might be quite complex to research. But if you've got a hint as to a regiment, obviously that makes it easier. But I was actually looking at the people, the regiments that fought in Korea, and there was quite a long list, including the Leicestershire Regiment. And I just wondered if you'd looked into that at all, because I don't know very much about the Leicestershire Regiment at that
time.
Yes,
if you go to the Regimental Museum here at Newark Houses Museum, they've actually got one of the displays in one of the cabinets there of a uniform talking about the battalion serving there. And I think when they finished there, they came back and then they moved on to other areas like Cyprus and things like that. And that was kind of coming towards the end of what they were doing when it came to the regiment. And then it kind of disbanded and eventually it's obviously become part of the Royal Anglian Regiment now. And the interesting thing talking to someone like Nick LeBand came in last week talking about digital mapping and stuff. Well, of course, when conflicts start like World War One or World War Two, you know, nice and easy, they're big conflicts, so therefore, you know, everybody gets called up. That, you know, the Leicestershire Regiment comes from Leicester and Leicestershire. As the war goes on and people get killed or injured, the replacements tend to come from further afield and people kind of get stuck. They might be living here in Leicestershire, but they don't necessarily have the geographical connection.
I think it does make research quite complicated. You've got to kind of persevere with it. And as you say, photographs can be useful, but it also might mean that you look at somebody and you think, well, that can't be them because that's not the right regiment. So military research can be quite complex.
Now, one of the things that I remember from your talk as well is you were talking about you had a relative that was in the fire service.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think what I discovered from talking to my mum was that one of our relatives who was too old to go to overseas service, if you like, was called up and was like, working in the anti-aircraft because of his age. But of course, you had a lot of people then that were, you know, in the home guard, or air raid wardens and all this kind of stuff, you know. That, and I think that was, for me, one of the things that I really took away from your event at VE Day that you did at OB at the tennis club, was looking at all of the list of people locally in OB that were like fire service, medical people, you know, like doing air raid protection and stuff like that. It was thousands of people at home that were involved in the war effort. And we always think about the people that go away and fight, but we never really think about the people at home as such.
Well, I mean, the 1939 register is really useful in that respect because it does tell you things like, oh, they were an air raid warden or what their role was. So, you know, you'll find that your parents or grandparents or whatever did have a role, but as you say, they weren't actually on active service. But it's worth looking up if you have adult members of your family who might have been alive in 1939 to see what they were actually doing at the time. The other thing I'd mention actually is newspaper reports, because you'd be surprised how many people turn up in a newspaper and you'd think, well, no, you know, it won't be a birth, marriage or death. But somebody found a Home Guard uniform, and they got in touch with us and said, can you find out who this person was or any more about him? Well, the newspaper report that we tracked down had got information about him, because Home Guard records, you know, a little bit few and far between. But he was really grateful because we found it. I can't remember exactly where he was based, but a lot of people have got Home Guard family members and they want to find out a bit more about them.
Because we don't necessarily, when we're talking about in Remembrance Day, for example, you know, going overseas and where did they serve, and they served in the Far East or they served in Italy or, you know, post D-Day and things like that, or if they were in the Navy or the Air Force, we don't really think about service at home. But for people was just as important, this sort of, you know, the home front, the sort of the war, the collective war effort we forget about. You know, this was a nation at war for like 6 years with no understanding or awareness of when it was going to end. It's easy to look back now, isn't it, and go, oh, in 1944, you must have been delighted. D-Day is coming to an end in so many months. Well, you had no idea that was going to happen.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, just going back to the person you mentioned, the fireman, he was actually a fireman at the Natural History Museum. So I don't know whether that remained open during the war. I can't remember. I have looked into it. But he wasn't on fire service as you might, you know, looking at bombed houses, etc. But, you know, still find lots of information about him through other records. So that's quite interesting.
And it's that association, as wasn't it, being involved in something that's then involved in something else, thinking about, you know, coming from the East End of London, for example, you know, my dad was always like, you know, COVID wasn't going to get him because Hitler didn't, you know, it's like a family myth. Whereas we talk about, you know, because we live quite close to the docks were always getting hammered. And if they overshot the docks or undershot the docks, that's why the East End got bombed. But it was just talking about things like, you know, the Bethnal Green tube disaster, where the air raid went off and everybody went down and got crushed in the gates. I mean, you know, loads of people died, but it was all hushed up. It wasn't a story that came out until really after the war. We forget now, don't we, with 24-hour news and social media, that back then a lot of people didn't find out about things until after they'd finished.
Well, exactly. I mean, in terms of newspapers, again, you know, when you were getting the names of people who were missing, people who were imprisoned, etc., you know, and I think they were posting messages in sort of public places sometimes. That was more the First World War. But no, it's unimaginable, to be quite honest, to people living today. It's to just the war reportage, full stop, I think, in earlier times.
Yeah, newspapers and how it was controlled. And even, I guess, going to the cinema and watching newsreels about what was going on. Most of the time, this was after the event, you know, learning about big things. So, yeah, it's quite a fascinating time, isn't it? So you're listening to John Costa on the Spotlight on Heritage podcast with Rob Watson. So Rob, to bring you in here as well, because we've spoken before about, you know, there's not really any stories in your family that you can particularly remember about the war or anything like that sort of stuff. I mean, it must be there somewhere, and I know you've not looked for it, but what would it have been? You know, do you know anything about, you know, grandparents and things like that? Was there a lot of sort of factory work or?
I think that's down to me.
You just meant to say no.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of down to me not having that inquiring mind about this.
But do you think also it's because if it's not something that you're
I'll ask my mum before the next episode.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I mean, if it's not a thing that you think about, I mean, for example, my mum's mum served, but her husband died, and my dad's mum survived, but his dad died. So what I'm saying, my dad, I would say, was completely impacted by World War II when it came to sort of intergenerational trauma. I grew up with that from an empire, my nan talking about things, you know, the war was always one of those things. If you don't get that as a child, you're not necessarily going to pick up on
it. Well, it was there. And I suppose I'm kind of more future focused than past focused, but when you're in the present and you're with people who are, you know, it's the water that you swim in, you know, it's the pool that you regard as being normal. And it's only when you either get older and you've worked through that, or you move to somewhere else, that you realise how specific in time and place that culture was, which can never be reproduced and never be replicated. And then how do you explain it to people? So I've having kind of moved away, you know, and lived in Leicester longer than I ever lived in Liverpool, it's just a place to live. And other people will sort themselves out and do what they need to do. So I don't really kind of look to understand them from that historical perspective. It's a bit kind of living too much in the present and not being connected with it. But I can understand why people want to know where your roots and heritage are. And also I think, you know, in a way we've, you know, the kind of, let's use a phrase, the identity industry is often about people having quite assertive sense of telling their story, which is reinforced in the media, which actually pushes back an awful lot of that assumed heritage and identity that people have as a common sense of identity, because it's not special or it's not specifically related to people who are, to use a phrase, minoritized. So it's like that generalized sense of cultural heritage. It's kind of something that we don't attend to it and protect it, we lose it.
Mm, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, also, I mean, one of the conversations we've had, haven't we, Sue, over the past is about with Tina looking forward at projects that we can do out in communities in somewhere like Leicester, where there are either new arrival communities or communities in many extents have been here for sort of 60 or 70 years, is how do we help them to find out their story as well? So like we've got a really big sort of African Caribbean community sort of post Windrush, we've got the South Asian community, Uganda and Kenyan and East Asia. How do, when people come to you, or do they even think about coming to you as the Family History Society, that you would or you wouldn't have these records?
I don't think they particularly come to us. What I think they tend to do is if we meet them outside at an event, they start telling us their story. When you set up something at the adult ed place not long ago and I was handing out some leaflets, a lady came and said, oh, well, I came over in the 1960s. And I said, what brought you here? And she said, well, I came by myself and I just had a suitcase. And I said, you've got a great story here. And she said, and then the suitcase was stolen. And I, you know, what happened next? And to me, one important thing is trying to encourage those stories that might only go back two generations so that you're not necessarily needing to find records, but don't lose the story that's just two generations back, you know, involving your grandparents. Oh, my grandparents told me so-and-so. Because it is going to be more specialised if you're helping somebody, say, with Polish ancestry or, you know, somebody who's come from, over from China or whatever, just because we don't have the knowledge and expertise to help somebody researching, you know, how many different communities are there in Leicester now. So our feeling is let's get the first generation, the second generation story written and work from that. You know, you might well have old photographs. Who are they? Oh, that's my great-grandparents. Oh, yeah, I remember their names. Before that knowledge is forgotten, we all know about photographs that, you know, we've forgotten who the people are on the photos.
So, Sue, how many people come to you and are like, I need to go back as far as I can? Danny Dyer comes from Royal Heritage. I need to connect with this particular person, please, in my family tree. And how many people skip through those first two generation stories because to them that it's not really family history? It's too modern, it's too contemporary. They want to start getting back into the older stuff.
Well, I'd say it's almost 50-50. I mean, somebody came in last week, husband and wife. They were from America and they had been to Ireland, Scotland, and they'd come to Leicester. I don't think they'll be listening to this, but they hadn't really brought enough information with them. And I thought, well, you're going on this kind of world tour and you've not brought the facts. And they said, oh, we've had a DNA test and we've got back to John Hopkins baptised in Hinckley. And somebody in, I said, yes, but you've also got that he was living in 1760 in America. That's not going to quite work. And somebody has kind of conjured up this baptism in Hinckley in 17, whatever it was. Well, of course, when we look into it, this baptism of somebody in 1760 in Hinckley, the child had died a week later and they hadn't followed that through. The trouble with websites like Ancestry, they throw up hints. And they can take you in the wrong direction. Now, Hopkins isn't a particularly unusual name. So you can imagine how many John Hopkins there might be. If you've got a more unusual name, it might well be correct. But I'm not personally, I don't want to go back in my family history, you know, as far as I can. I've stopped at about 1740. I can't go back much further in some lines. But yeah, some people do. We've got a guy who comes in and I jokingly say, you know, have you got back to William the Conqueror yet? Because he's got names and possibilities. But before parish records, you're going to find it very, very difficult unless you are, you know, from a named family with an established pedigree, which is what Danny Dyer had, basically.
Luckily.
But also, Will Young found, he said, oh, there's a scroll involved. Great. I wanted there to be a scroll. And I think they found he was linked to one of the, you know, kings of England.
So, Sue, if I was to turn up in every street tomorrow, and you and like some of the volunteers are sitting there, like Linda, who won't come on the podcast, she's sitting here, but she won't say anything. So, Linda, and she's laughing now. How many of you are there that are waiting there to take me on this magical journey? And how quickly can you pull all this stuff out, books and scrolls, and get me back to William the Conqueror? Because it looks really easy on who do you think you are?
Well, with a bit of research, if it's a reasonably unusual name, in other words, it's not John Smith, I would think we could, within an hour, go back several generations in the census. Now, as soon as you get back to 1837, you're going to be looking particularly at other records. And then they are, some of them are online, but you've got to do more detailed research. But we've got two volunteers on duty all the time. Sometimes we've got three volunteers. And they can sit you down and say, well, what do you know already? Obviously, the more you know when you come in, like my grandparents' names and where they lived, you know, if you don't know anything, which is fine, but the more you know, the easier it is to start researching. I mean, your mum came in and, you know, we've looked at various lines and made some really interesting discoveries. And I would say, you'd be surprised, I think, Rob, if you came in, we might find just that one little discovery that you thought, oh, that's interesting. We've actually been using Google Earth a bit. As you know, we went to the Emerald Centre And we were finding a house in Dublin where somebody's grandparents had lived. And they were like, wow, you found where they lived. And it's like,
so it's not just about photographs of people, it's about places and where they're from and what it was like then.
You know, it particularly, say, sometimes a road has been demolished, but an old postcard will show you what the road looked like. I've got one in, from a family member in London. It was bombed. But there's a great photograph that I happened to find online of the street. You know, it's really I find it quite moving. I mean, you know, I think there's an emotional connection, and I'll help other people. When your mother made that interesting discovery about her family in Kew in Bristol, sends goosebumps down my back just thinking about it. You know, it was a spooky discovery. And I think a lot of people will find one of those when they start researching.
We'll have to get Rob to come in. We'll have to do a special. Rob down the rabbit hole. There we go. So let's just finish off today. Now, we've recently had VE Day, and, you know, we came to your event, which was fantastic, and it's interesting to see people looking at their old photos and making discoveries and stuff. And in the journey that me and my mum have been on since my dad died last year, we've started to think about more about, you know, this kind of stuff. And I'm doing the military history research, and she's doing more of sort of the family story. And one of the things that came out of it was that my mum came to me and said, I want to talk to you about VE Day from the perspective that her mum, my mama, I guess, and my granddad, John, who I'm named after, would have been married and was married at VE Day. We've discovered mama was here in Glenparva, stationed here with the ATS, and John was down in Oxfordshire, and he was killed in July in an air crash in the RAF. So my mum was like, well, on VE Day, they were happy the war was over and started thinking about, well, we can buy a house and where we put our presents, and started to think about raising a family. And my mum got quite emotional about it. But that's the first time we'd ever thought about, actually, on VE Day, they probably would have been really happy. They might not have been together, but they were really happy and they were going to get on with their life. And then he dies 2 months later after, in inverted commas, the war's finished. Mm. I know we were still fighting the Japanese, but that perception. And I think that's kind of changed our relationship with our relatives and what we're doing with the project, because we'd never really thought about that particular moment. Is something like VE Day or, you know, Armistice Day or any of these kind of commemorations things that drive people to get in touch with you at the Family History Society?
I certainly think it's events like that bring back memories. I mean, in the Odeby thing that I'm involved in, we put out a request, have you got, you know, there are names on the war memorial from the Second World War. We've not seen any photographs of them, but we asked, has anybody in the community got a photograph of a soldier? And one or two had, and they sent them in. Well, we'd not seen those before, and Odeby as a community hadn't seen those before. So I think people were starting to think, well, I remember my mother saying to me such and such.
Because these would have been stories that would have been passed on when they were children.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a certain, you've got to be a certain age to have been there. And, you know, you might remember a street party. One of our members, for instance, who's 90, does remember and has got his own memories. But unless you're, you know, 88, you're not going to have that firsthand memory. But I think people are saying, how do you get this service record? We've had a lot of inquiries about that. Or when I get the service record, how do I interpret the language, because it's quite complex, you know, it's lots of scrawly notes and whatever. We've got an expert.
It tends to be a lot of shorthand as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Terminology that you wouldn't know, abbreviations. Somebody's done that. We've said, well, come in. We've got a guy who is very good at reading service records, and we'll be able to help this lady with what she needs to know, because it is quite specialised. And although we've learned a bit more about some of the terminology, sometimes you do need a bit of an expert view. And there are a lot, as you know, of expert military historians out there who will say, oh, yeah, it's been so-and-so.
Yeah, particularly if it helps you with you interpreting badges and uniforms. And I think also what happens is, you know, having been in the army, I kind of understand ORBAT, like orders of battle and all these kind of things, and how many people are in a battalion or a section or a platoon. But you start looking at this stuff and the terminology, then you start mixing up where people went with units. You can get yourself completely lost, and that's really where the value of having someone like this comes in.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, when we were talking about the First World War, if you can't find a service record, one thing you can do, of course, is look at the regimental diary and it'll tell you where that regiment was around the time that your family member died. And that was some information that was passed on to us. Like, that's another way that you can research, along with things like absent voters. You know, that's a great list of First World War and Second World War. You know, where was your family member? Were they at home in Leicester in 1945, or were they still fighting? And the absent voters lists will tell you those. And we've got access to them at the Family History Society. Should you need to look at them?
Rob, they've got everything waiting to open up your family history to you completely when we do it. We're going on the road with Spotlight on Heritage. So, Sue, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Nice to chat to you, John.